Hi, it's Jeannie Allen, and this is Reality Check. I am so pleased to be bringing this podcast to you from San Diego, California, at the 10th annual ASU GSV Summit. This is the go-to summit for innovators, entrepreneurs, edtech people, folks who want to drive acceleration innovation. I gotta tell you, it is the most active, exhilarating thing that we do annually. I'm so excited to be bringing to you a dozen or so people who are doing everything from pre-K to gray, as they say, and all in between. So take a listen, and you will be here with me live as you learn about these fascinating innovators that are helping transform the world of education for learners at all levels. So Bobby, why do you like HolonIQ?
Oh, I just think it's a good looking at the data to understand what's happening in the trends in ed tech, the trends in what's going on in the future of work, future of education. It's a lot of data, and the analysis of it's important. I'm looking at it because I'm writing a book on women in ed tech globally and why they are successful.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, so I am talking with Bobby Kirshan. She is the founder of the Ed Entrepreneurship Program, the Innovation Portal, if you will, at University of Pennsylvania. And I had the pleasure of working with her and being a student, first cohort of the Master's in Science and Education Entrepreneurship. And Bobby has been a woman in ed tech. So why do you come here, though? What does ASU GSV do for ed tech, do for women?
I must be crazy to come here, but other than that, I come because I think it's a place to see what's happening in the trends. I think it's a place to meet a lot of people in one place. I find that it's a good place to start conversations. They certainly don't end, and it's very rarely that any actual work or accomplishments happen, but it's a good place to start conversations.
So you are really unique in the field in a lot of ways, and one of them I think is interesting is you always seem to recognize that there's quality people that are able to contribute to this ecosystem and innovation no matter what level they are. Right. And so you've had a lot to do with bringing young people together and just newer entrants, even if they're not younger, to the field. Why is that important to populate and intersperse new folks?
I think that goes to the diversity of the field and the diversity of who we're serving. I mean, some recent research we did on entrepreneurial mindset, we found out that most educators are very low risk takers because they follow the medical creed of do no harm, and yet they're highly empathetic. So I look at the diversity and the empathy role and the risk-taking role and figure out how to balance that and provide them the skills and tools they need to succeed.
That's so smart. And finally, you were an investor.
Yes, still am. And
still are an investor. What do you look for in a great investment? So people who are out there thinking about how to pitch, who to talk to.
Well, I look for somebody that's solving a problem, a big problem. I see a lot of solutions with no problems. So I run around at exhibits like this, and everybody's pushing their solution, but I'm not sure what problem they're solving. And the other thing that I look for is a passion for it. You have to be extremely passionate. If you're not passionate about it, it's not going to succeed.
That's great. Oh, I'm so glad you came to talk to me. Thank you, Bobby. You're amazing.
Bye.
Thank you. I am talking with Bruce Davis, a veteran entrepreneur in the education space who is leading a company called TeachStone. And I want to know, and our listeners want to know, what does TeachStone do, Bruce?
Sure. Jeannie, thanks for having me. TeachStone is a teacher assessment and training company that focuses on classroom skills, very narrowly on what it takes to be a great classroom instructor. And we have a methodology that was derived from research at the University of Virginia over a 20-year period of time, which gets at the heart of what really great teaching is, irrespective of grade level or curriculum. And we impart a series of important skills for communications, social and emotional development, classroom organization, discipline, condensed down into a program that's meant to make teachers a really great classroom instructor in a relatively brief period of time. And the program is adopted nationally by the Head Start community as their principal quality improvement system.
Oh, wow.
And in 23 states. So we're a broadly national company now and educating over 200,000 teachers a year.
So is this an example of how ed tech and innovation can improve something that didn't happen before? In other words, I think about, like, why doesn't that already happen in the course of a teacher's training?
Well, teachers are often trained in schools of education and don't get the practical experience they need to be great classroom instructors. And so without a live classroom to practice with, there's a limit to how far you can theoretically take a teacher. And I liken what we do to flight training, where until you pull back on the stick and go up in the air, you've never really flown a plane, no matter how much you've studied the Bernoulli effect.
That's a great analogy. Mm-hmm. So what brings you to ASU GSV 19, the 10th? And you're probably, what, like, been most to most of them?
I think I've been to all of them. Yes, I think I've been to all of them. Well, of course, it's a fabulous networking event. It's a who's who of education, and everybody's here. So it's an efficient forum to meet with a lot of people. In this particular year, I'm trying to raise some capital for development of digital tools that we want to do around our methodology. And I have, you know, several important meetings with potential customers as well.
That's fantastic. Well, it's cool because you see there's investors looking for products and products looking for investors and services. And some people, including lots of folks here from, you know, around the world, China, looking just to connect.
Right, that's
right. It's a very cool vibe. Okay, so what do you want, like, what's the biggest takeaway this year for people listening about education innovation? Are we making progress? Mm-hmm. Are we getting better? What's the big buzz?
I think the big buzz, at least in my mind as I observe what's going on in the industry and at this conference, is that it's just getting bigger, right? That everyone is recognizing now that education can be transformed by technology. And there have been a lot of forces that resisted that over the years, but I think those are falling away. And the younger generation of people are more open to it, and so teachers are adopting it, schools are adopting it, and there are more and more smart people building tools for the marketplace and more investment capital trying to support those tools and help make a difference.
That's so true. There's this energy among a lot of the educators here that's really exciting. And thank you for being part of it, for always leading and being out there to try to improve some aspect of education. Bruce Davis, Teach Stone, thanks for being a guest today on Reality Check.
Great. Thanks for including me.
Okay, we are in Innovation Alley. That's my new name for the space that CER and Reality Check are broadcasting from at ASU GSV. And my next victim guest is Jeremy Rossman, who is the founder of Make School, which is a new university based in San Francisco. And this is so exciting, Jeremy, because we're all talking about how higher education isn't working for most kids. So what did you do? What are we talking about here?
Well, my co-founder and I actually left college and took our frustrations, but also our insights into how computer science could and should be taught, and started our own. And we are in the interesting position of being college dropouts that now run an accredited college program.
Only in America.
And I would say I hope to be, you know, the first of a new wave of institutions that are trying to redefine prestige by outcome and not by who gets in, and really focus on providing an education that is relevant to students' career interests. And so we do that in San Francisco. You know, we have a campus, faculty, dorms, and, you know, part of the deal is that students don't have to pay unless they get a job. And to us, that's very important. And I think that that financial model is one that we hope to see, you know, spread across higher ed.
Right. Is that the income-based repayment model? Do you work with a company that basically bets on the students?
So we bet on the students, and we were actually the first institution to do any sort of long-form program on this model in this day and age. So when you hear universities like Purdue adopting income share agreements, they're adopting the documents that we helped roll out back in 2014, actually. We've been doing this for a while now. We do work with a company that helps, you know, draft and administer these documents, but we're not transferring the risk to some other party.
You're holding the risk.
We are holding the risk.
So you're holding the accountability.
Exactly. If our students don't get paid, we don't get paid. That's how it works.
And it sounds like what you're describing also with computer science, it's competency-based, right? Because you can't say I'm a four-year institution, or does it have to be? Like, what's the time? How does it work differently from traditional higher ed?
So that's a very interesting question. The program is actually accredited as a bachelor's program, but it is seat time based. And that is, you know, has definitely attracted some interest because folks instinctively think, you know, perhaps this should be a competency-based program. And I think one day it might be. But the way that this came about was through a new policy that was instituted by the accreditor that covers California and Hawaii called WASC. They also accredit, you know, Stanford and UC Berkeley and all these great schools.
Mm-hmm.
And they created a policy called the incubation policy, which allows new institutions like ours to offer accredited programs by partnering with an established institution. And so what we've done is we've worked with essentially the most innovative accreditor in the United States and maintained a lot of things about our program that people thought were not possible with accreditation. We have some faculty who don't even have bachelor's degrees. It's all project-based. And the students are launching products in class. We are not reverting back to a traditional system of problem sets and GPAs and so on and so forth. And we were able to maintain that even with a seat time accreditation. Students can actually accumulate enough credits to graduate with a bachelor's degree in as few as 2 years on our accelerated degree path. And the majority of our students do pursue that. So it is very special in a number of ways, and I think in large part due to the openness of the accreditor to consider a college that looks like ours. And frankly, I think what it really did it for them was being under new leadership and open innovation, but also seeing that we've been operating it since 2014 as a non-degree program. And so a lot of the proof was in the pudding. You know, when Facebook and Google are hiring out of this new alternative institution, that says something. And so coming to them already, having been at that stage where these top employers are hiring from us, I think helped, you know, kind of put data behind a lot of what we hope to see in higher ed, which is open-mindedness to innovation.
Right.
And it wasn't just this blind jump, given that we had the track record to show that this teaching model, this faculty, and this pedagogy really works.
And a degree that actually leads to outcomes in terms of both competencies earned and gained and a job at the other end of the tunnel. So what do you say to kids like mine and others out there who grew up with this traditional mindset that if they don't graduate from a traditional four-year college that someone heard of,
right,
that it's not good enough? Like, what do we do about that?
I think that mindset obviously is shifting, and we're seeing a lot of the narrative move towards skills over degrees. I think what we're trying to show is that it's a false choice. And that in fact, I mean, the U.S. is massive, and there are plenty of colleges out there that are doing a better job at this than the average college. And so if you start thinking of college as an investment, and not just as a destination or a box to tick, you start thinking of it, it's not, oh, I should invest in stocks. It's, I should buy the ones that will do well. I should not go to any college. I should look up and do my research to find the one that's a good fit. You quickly can uncover data that is just not part of the conversation. For example, the Department of Education, a cousin of mine actually worked on this, so I'm very proud of it, created a scorecard that you can access online and see what the career earnings look like, what the repayment rates look like, what the average cost of attendance look like for various institutions. And the other side of that equation is, in addition to thinking about ones that already exist that might be out there that you don't know about, there are new colleges being started for the first time in a long time, I think, that are credible, high integrity, high outcome colleges, schools like ours, like Minerva also in San Francisco. And so what I think that's showing is that the frameworks of accreditation and the system, slow as it may be in general, may be catching up to the new reality that actually it needs to be skill and degree, not skill or degree.
Mm-hmm.
And so to your kids, I would say, listen, there may be non-degree programs out there that are a better fit than college. There may be colleges out there that are a better fit than the ones you've looked at. It's all about treating it as an investment,
right,
and to keep an eye out for this new reality that new institutions like ours are starting to bridge the gap between what students want, what employers want, and what can actually exist in the framework of a accredited degree-granting higher education institution.
And they don't have to put the money up front. They just have to do the work.
That's right. They
get to pay for it.
That's right. And we are really proud of the fact that the demographics of our program look nothing like the demographics of a top computer science school anywhere else. And, you know, schools will do a lot of PR about how accessible they are and the financial aid they offer. You can think of the top schools and how they're very, very, you know, proud of these financial aid programs. But the reality is they don't admit students from those backgrounds. So it doesn't matter that, you know, a family under XYZ income can go for free to Stanford when on average only like 3 or 4% of students at Stanford come from the bottom 20% of families by income. So By adopting an incentive-aligned model where we make a bold statement, we say, listen, we're not going to get paid unless you get paid. And you don't have to put any money up front. You don't have to go into debt. And actually, we'll cover your rent in our dorms and we'll give you money for food if you can't afford it. We're attracting a student population that comes from backgrounds that are vastly underrepresented in tech. We're creating the first credible pathway for low-income and minority students in the United States in large numbers to access tech jobs at companies like Stanford, Facebook, and the next, you know, Facebook and Google. And we are actually having students now outcompete their peers at these top institutions for outcomes, which shows you that actually prestige should really be about where the students go and not where they come from.
Exactly.
And I think we're also proving that with a project-based model where students' portfolios can be their prestige, not the name of the degree, not a school that you've heard of. Even when no one had heard of Make School in 2014, our students were getting interviews at top companies and the strengths of the portfolios that they built in our program. And I think a lot of programs are going to turn to that direction and realize if it's skills and degrees, then there's ways to demonstrate those skills. And there's ways to short-circuit these established notions of prestige and these established recruiting pipelines because companies simply can't afford not to be hiring from these new schools that are actually providing the talent that they need.
So prestige is where you're going, not where you came from. That's fascinating. Maybe you've said it before. Maybe it's out there. I think that should be the saying, moniker for the next 24 months at least.
To be honest, we said it for the first time today. We just announced that we raised another round of funding, and that was kind of the new headline. Well, Redefining Elite, prestige is where you're going, not where you come from.
It's sticky. I love it, Jeremy Rossman. Thank you so much for joining me. Jeremy Rossman, Make School San Francisco. Look him up. I'm sure we can follow you on Twitter.
On Instagram is where our prospective students should be following us. You know, that's where everyone's
that
at.
We
have a lot of great content there for young students interested in tech, and so you know, Make School and Instagram is the place to be, and Twitter, of course, too.
All right, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much.
All right, I am sitting here at ASU GSV 19 with Melissa Lazzaro, the Director of Scales for LexFlor.com.
Yeah.
Melissa, tell us what you do, why are you here, and what does innovation mean to you?
Sure, so this is our second time at ASU GSV. We are rapid reading assessment. So we use an eye tracker with artificial intelligence to determine a child's reading ability in 2 minutes. And so innovation for us is using technology to help teachers and students get the information they need to make those personalized learning decisions and save time.
Okay, that's actually amazing. And I bet every parent, grandparent, citizen in America would go like, why wouldn't we do that for everyone everywhere? Is it hard to do?
Yeah.
Like, how does that get done?
It's really easy to train people. Some of the networks that we're working with, they have aides in every classroom. They're, you know, it's a benefit that they have. And so we've trained their aides. The teachers then have more time for instruction. Other schools have their special education teachers do it. Other schools have their teachers do it because they want their teachers really looking at that data and making those decisions. I volunteered for an organization called Junior Achievement, and so I took the technology into my son's fifth grade classroom, and I said, hey, do you want to do a reading assessment for 45 minutes, or do you want to do it for 2 minutes? And the kids are like, why don't we have this? This is so awesome. 2 minutes? So it was, you know, just the kids think it's fun, and it's just great to get the teacher that data that they need, and yet the kids have a really positive assessment experience.
So they get assessed, and let's say you find out they're at a certain level.
Sure.
And then that level dictates how those kids learn after that?
So we break up the data into 5 different reading levels, reading ability levels. So we're really capturing every different level of student, those that are at highest risk for reading failure, those that need to be challenged more at the top of the scale, those we need to keep our eye on, and those we just need to keep maintaining. And so those that are on the lower end, we do have some recommendations. They're free resources with our partner, BrainSpring, and some online resources for teachers as well. And that was developed organically by our teachers saying, hey, we'd love some additional instruction here that's not tied to curriculum, but that we can immediately work with these kids that are struggling. What can we do? So, you know, you get the you get a visualization of the child reading, like a recording of how the brain is processing language.
Wow.
And then on the back end, it's calculating about 200 variables to produce the data points that you see, words per minute, you know, your typical fluency measures, percentile. We have grade level equivalent coming out in the next couple of months. And then you also can hear the child read. So as a teacher, I can go back and listen for some skill deficits maybe that I need to work on with the kid.
Right.
As a principal, I now get to see and hear the child read, which normally I wouldn't be able to do because I don't want to intimidate a child sitting in the classroom. And so the site director is able to have that information.
And the contrast as you're talking, and I'm thinking between your typical average traditional classroom, which sure. I get that more and more are becoming less traditional, of a child doing a reading a lesson, and then being assessed, and then they move on without this kind of demonstration as clearly as these tools make possible. It just, it opens up your mind to what we could do for literacy, which of course is foundational, right,
yeah.
for equity.
Right. Well, I'll tell you how to guide into this. So my son has dyslexia, and I identified him in first grade, and unfortunately my school assessed him and didn't identify him as being flagged for a reading disability until third grade. So my son didn't even learn how to read until almost fourth grade. And that was with private tutoring and everything else. And so it just really evoked this passion for me. And we got to identify these kids early. We have the technology to do it. Let's not burden teachers with, you know, longer assessments. Let's not burden students with longer assessments.
Right.
And let's get the data in the hands to help these kids as soon as possible so they never have to go into special education. So they get the interventions they need and we preserve their self-esteem in the process, right? So it's hard for me to subdue my passion, but it's where I'm at.
Well, Melissa Lazzaro, LexPlore, I am so glad that you took the time to talk with us about this and particularly on this issue. We need that passion. We need that change. That's why we're here.
Yeah.
And here's to innovation in reading and success for kids.
Yeah, thanks.
I am with Candace Tolliver Burns, the Chief Communications Officer for the fantastic Friendship Public Charter Schools, mm-hmm. located in Washington, D.C.,
right.
with schools in many states.
That's correct.
And Candace was just in a really provocative panel at ASU GSV 19 on the return to Black-led schools. Tell us about what you got out of that discussion.
Well, I think the focus of returning to Black-led schools is really about supporting African-American students. It's about supporting education equity. It's about valuing every student, no matter where they live, what they look like, what their income may be. And so it's about building these institutions that really uplift all our kids.
And you made a comment, which you made so many comments, which are fantastic, Candace, but you were talking about the experience of the community and bringing this to the community and what happens in a community when you empower people to really be involved in their students' lives. What have you seen in terms of successes with Friendship's approaches and this community kind of DNA you have?
Well, I'll tell you, Friendship from its very beginning focused on weaving in its parents, and not even on the back end, I'll say on the front end. Whenever we go into a community or we're asked to adopt a school, the first thing we do is we have a conversation with our parents and our surrounding community. We hear, what are your aspirations? What are your goals for your community school? What do you look for? What are your expectations? And then we talk about how we're going to collectively achieve those expectations. So parent involvement, community involvement, I would say we're extended family involvement, means everything.
And how do you see that as innovative versus the traditional system, just anything you do? Like you're at an innovation conference, there's a lot about what goes into effective schools that's just tried and true. But what do you all do that you say this is breakout?
I think what we do is we look at specifically what do our students need, what do they need once they leave our community, and how are we providing them with a foundation that gives them the option to soar once they leave Friendship. And so that might mean that you're not operating in the cookie cutter fashion, right? That means it's STEM immersion, or it's foreign language, or it's a lot of one-on-one study with students, or it's project-based learning, or it's arts immersion. We look at, you know, what do our parents want? What do our community want? What do they want? And then moreover, what do our kids need to leave us and be outstanding? And that doesn't seem very revolutionary. It just kind of makes practical sense. But
Well, sometimes using a pencil is innovative. It just depends on how you use it,
how
right?
You use it. That's right.
So you all had also a robotics program that I thought, think won national competitions?
Oh my gosh. Let me tell you, our kids are blowing, just blowing every opportunity, every standard out the water. So we had one of our tech prep students, he's a junior, he won the DC Google Science Fair. I mean, just kill the competition. Secondly, we had two other students who won the DC STEM Fair. And this is tech prep, high, in Ward 8, competing against, you know, Georgetown Day, Sidwell Friends, you name it. And our kids had an awesome time, but more importantly, their innovation was toe-to-toe with their peers. And that's what it's all about.
And really, it does not matter who these kids are, how they grew up. If you put a school, is what you're saying to me, in a community and give them access to the tools, the resources, the thought leadership, mm-hmm. the innovation that everybody else has in more affluent communities, they can thrive.
It's about resources. You know, people, listen. I think a lot of times the same challenges that we're seeing in some of these historically the traditional public school system, it could just happen almost anywhere. It's all about how are we valuing kids and are we putting the money behind what we say we believe. And so at Friendship, that's what we do. I mean, we're fundraising. We are reaching out to partners. We're doing everything that we must do to ensure that our students have every resource possible. Donald Hintz, who started this system 21 years ago, said, you know, I'm looking at these kids, I'm looking at the state of education in the District of Columbia, and he was faced with what was seen as dropout factories. And these parents, just in anguish, came to him and said, you know, we need options, but we don't know how in the world we're going to access them. And as things would have it, that came the advent of the charter school law. And he said, why don't we take this opportunity so that our students in Ward 8 and Ward 7 and elsewhere can have the same quality education as students in other areas? And so that's what it's all about. It's really about equity and fairness.
And opportunity, as you said.
And opportunity,
as well.
Absolutely.
I mean, this whole notion that it should not matter what school, where that school is. It's about having the opportunity to access the school that best meets your needs. So Friendship has 12 schools in Washington, D.C., mostly clustered in Wards 7 and 8.
Well, mostly clustered there, but we're in all five wards, Wards 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. We run the only K-8 free online public charter school, as well as a free public charter high school that's housed on our Collegiate Academy campus in Ward 7.
That's fantastic. And you're also in what other cities?
We're in state Louisiana and in Arkansas.
And you know how to deal and support and advance students who really need and aren't getting this kind of education elsewhere. Are you guys looking to grow and expand?
We are. Okay. I'll leave that announcement to our CEO, Patricia Brantley. You know, as you well know, Ms. Brantley, you've worked with her for years. Some years ago, I think about 13 years ago, when she joined Friendship as the Chief Operating Officer, she was very much part of this expansion of Friendship in D.C. So, yes, good news is on the horizon.
It's great news for everybody around the country. Candace, thank you for joining
me
here at ASU.
Thank you for all the great work.
Thank you.
All right.
I am with John Hage, the founder and CEO of Charter Schools USA, the immediate past chairman of the Center for Education Reform. It was such a joy to work with you in that capacity, but gosh, this is what we're here for, ASU GSV 19, innovation, 10 years. Can you believe this?
Unbelievable. 10 years, right? Geez. I guess we're getting older.
We're getting older, but I'm telling you, it's like that every year there's this vibe here, John, about innovation and accelerating. What are you getting from this conference?
So far, you know, part of it is, Jeannie, we just all love being around all the creativity, the smart people, the energy. It's so nice to see that education is so much more than just, right, thought of as, oh, teaching and books. It's so much more than that now. It's the innovation coming from the financial sector and how they invest in what's happening and the new ideas. It's the innovation from technology and artificial intelligence, and all of it coming together in this place for us, I think, is why we come here. We have a big presence, and it's our 10 years And I remember, I think you and I came to the first one.
We did.
We're veterans.
And so Charter Schools USA started 20 years ago.
Yeah, our first school, 1998. So actually, I think we're going in our 21 years, yeah.
And you now have almost 100 schools.
Yeah, we're just under 100, and we'll have 75,000 kids in our schools this fall. And we're growing, and we're doing some great new innovative things, and we're birthing babies and new organizations even.
Well, that's what's amazing to think about is that you have this team here and you are talking to people, they're networking, they're learning, having discussions about reading acceleration and math and just different learning strategies. And as you said, just kind of learning and watching. Why is that not the norm in education? Like, why isn't there teams of people from districts just like grabbing people and saying, come help me?
Well, I think it really comes down to the fundamentals of why reform in itself is succeeding and why status quo isn't, and that is that we're incentivized to succeed. It's not just that the organizational model is more innovative, it's that the underlying idea that if you are doing something that moves the needle for students and for kids, you actually, grow your business model and you become successful and you can serve more kids. And so I think, unfortunately, in traditional systems, there's no real incentive. Nobody actually, gets promoted over the right things anymore. They get promoted for longevity. It's, not for necessarily creative innovation. There's no social entrepreneurship in the DNA.
Mm-hmm.
In our DNA, there's this do good, do well model that actually is incentivized by, that. And the same with the charter world, right? Like, if you succeed, you replicate and you expand. If you don't, you get shut down. So that is not in the DNA of traditional education in this country, and that's unfortunate. But it's also why this sector is exploding still, even mm-hmm. with its struggles, even with its areas where we don't take ground in every state all the time, even with the great work CER does to help that happen. My view of it is I'm extremely optimistic. I think this is a 100-year movement, and we're only a quarter of a century into it.
That's a great point. That really is. And what role does choice have to play in how fast innovation accelerates?
Everything. In fact, I look at choice so much more than just parent choice, right? I think of choice as the choice for students in the classroom to own their own educational enterprise and to be involved earlier and younger in making choices, because we know that students that are engaged in their educational environment, that own their own learning outcomes, are going to be more successful. Choice in parents, obviously, owning where their kids go, but not just that, owning choices within the school. Why this teacher over that teacher, or this innovation platform over this one, or this reading concept. I think it's also choice, though, in enterprise value, meaning how many of us here have still choices today we didn't have 10 years ago, 20 years ago, for different applications to drive student learning. And so in our network of schools, we're actually using this innovation to say, hey, let's let some schools try this and other schools try that. And that choice is working as well, which is that there's now, we're a laboratory too. And that laboratory really is allowing for our teachers and our education leaders to experiment and yet at the same time drive innovation, because when something succeeds, everybody else hears about it and they follow that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they don't, they're going to shift to something else. And that's a good choice too.
Really is. John Hage, my guest, Charter Schools USA, my friend, thank you for what you've been doing for all of these years. Thank you for the millions of students you've impacted through your work. And thanks for actually taking time to show up. You're a CEO, you're a busy guy, and you're running around here having conversations with everyone, and it is just such a model.
Well, thank you. And I just want to say, CER, quarter century, it's been a pleasure being on your board and having served. And I really do believe with Ed Maven and the launch of what's going to be happening, CER's best days are ahead. And, folks here don't really know what it took to get here, but they're going to realize what it takes to get to the next level.
That's
so
right.
Congratulations.
Thanks, John. I am sitting here with Anne Brown, the Vice President of the Waterford Research Institute, which is a fabulous EdTech organization that is devoted to helping children learn to read. Is that a good way to put it?
That's a great way, yeah.
So, and you do it. I mean, lots of people teach reading. We've spoken to other people on Reality Check, Ann, about their programs that deliver great results to kids. But you really do have this long research base and experience that actually transcends the classroom. And so I would love you to talk a little bit about how Waterford does its work with students.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So we're actually a 40-year-old nonprofit. So we've been in this space focusing on the research and implementation of great quality reading instruction. We start by getting kids ready for school in the home. And then we work with them to become good readers between pre-K and second grade. And then from third grade to 12th grade, we focus on using reading to learn. So in the home program, we call that Upstart. And what we do with that is we put software in the home. If the families need it, we'll put the technology, we'll put the internet in the home as well. And I think the most important thing that we do with that is we engage with the families and coach the parents. So once children are enrolled, within 48 hours, they're contacted by their family education liaison. And that liaison will work with them for the entire year, weekly communication, if not more. And it's live communication where they have a real relationship with someone who understands them, understands their family, understands their child, and we're helping them understand the importance of literacy, the importance of being engaged with their child from an education perspective, establishing rituals and routines for how to use our system for 15 minutes a day, which ultimately helps them establish rituals and routines for what homework's going to look like as they get older.
Right.
They're building towards a graduation, so they have to have a certain amount of usage and a certain amount of consistency of usage in order to get to that graduation. And we're very proud to say we serve almost half of the four-year-olds in the state of Utah.
Oh my gosh.
In addition, we have smaller programs in 18 states across the country. And in general, we graduate about 91% of the kids who enter our program will exit having met the requirements to
be able to then go into kindergarten.
To graduate. And so the result of that is these children enter kindergarten at mid-year kindergarten skills to first grade level skills.
Wow.
And so then when children enter school, because we don't work with all children in the home, but as children enter school, we bring the software into the schools, and not just those children. We work with about 250,000 kids across the country in the K through 3 arena, and those children will use our software 15 minutes a day, focused again on literacy. There's also math and science if they want to do that. And we have phenomenal results with that as well. And then our new endeavor is our curricula program that starts at third grade. And that's really using reading to learn, and we want children to engage and enjoy and have an intrinsic joy for literacy and reading and literature. So that's kind of what we do as we get older.
And so I'm fascinated. The results are amazing. You're in all these homes in Utah. You're in homes. You do not have to go to a preschool for your child to learn how to get ready for kindergarten, to learn the literacy skills necessary for kindergarten. That's kind of a stretch for a lot of people. Like, how does that happen?
So by no means are we trying to replace pre-K. That's why we call it at-home school readiness. Pre-K has a lot of components that we don't have. We're not custodial to the children. We're not housing them. We're not feeding them. But what we are doing is focusing on their academics. And so what happens often with children is they on their first day of kindergarten, they're being evaluated on, do they know their letters? Do they know their sounds? Can they sit still? If they don't know those things, they're tracked almost from day one into a different track. If they do know those things, you know, we hear stories of families that say, oh, my child's in the first grade reading group, or my child is a mentor to other children, right? Because they come in academically ready to engage in school. So we are not pre-K, but we are providing an academic support that, you know, children may or may not get in a pre-K.
Well, so, and a lot of kids don't have access to pre-K, right?
A lot of schools. A lot of rural children don't,
right.
and a lot of them don't have access to high quality pre-K. You know, as lovely as it is to, you know, be with, you know, Miss Jones program down the street,
right.
It's maybe not, doesn't have all of the components that they need. And we don't discriminate against kids who are in pre-K. I mean, many of our children are in a pre-K. It could be a private or a public, and they still want to engage with Upstart
right.
in the home. So we've really, you know, taken the lowest common denominator of support, which is the home, and made it accessible for everyone. And again, if you're in a rural environment, I mean, we recently were awarded an Education Innovation and Research Grant from the U.S. Department of Ed, so we could expand these services into 5 states. These are 5 states that didn't have pre-K services through the state, so Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota.
Wow.
So now we're working into those 5 states and providing this service. And even if you look at, you know, if you look at the availability of preschool, you know, not even academic or just any kind of preschool, it's few and far between. You often would be, even if you had a centralized preschool for a district, you might be asking a child to be on a bus for 2 hours, which you just can't do, to, you know, to go to a centralized preschool
exactly.
center.
Exactly, and so more and more kids are living and families are living in those environments because, A, it's cheaper, right, to go
yeah.
farther out.
Yep.
And because of the advent of technology, so here's a question for you, because a lot of people, even friends I have who are more affluent, will say, oh my gosh, my kid's going to school, but they only think that iPads are, mm-hmm. you know, iPads are working, and I thought they were going to learn to read normally, right? So even those of us who are online all the time think that our kids are somehow getting a lesser education because they're deploying technology. How do you answer that for a small child who, I guess we think, you know, nostalgically, I want her with her doll or him with his car, and yes, I'm being totally gender discriminatory because that's where I am. But you know what I mean? What
right.
is that
Well,
response?
First of all, we agree with you. We want children to be playing. We want them to be outdoors. We want them to engage with their friends, and we want them to engage with their families. What we do want to do, though, is we want them to spend 15 minutes a day focusing on their academics. And in that 15 minutes, it can be a condensed time because it's so directed and scaffolded to exactly what their needs are. So our children are not you know, getting a skills hit. They're getting a full instructional objective presented to them. They would have a song. They would have instruction. They'll have application. They'll have assessment, and the children wouldn't know they're being assessed, but that assessment will determine should they do that again, and if they do it again, we don't do it right again. We set it aside and let them come back to it in a little bit of time. And then also we're reporting information back to their caregivers, and so both to their parents and to their family education liaison. So when we start to see that a child's not understanding something, we can help coach the parent to engage with the child, or the family education liaison can engage with the child. So what we're doing is creating a play-based environment that is academically focused. But again, we're only working on it for 15 minutes. We actually can see if a child is on the system for like 30 minutes a day
mm-hmm.
and counsel the parents that we really feel like that's too much. You know, so we're looking at that as well. And as far as reading goes, who knows what reading is going to be in the future?
Right.
Right? Like, they need to open books, and we want them to read books. They may or may not be in the home, so at least we're giving them reading materials.
Right.
If they are in the home, we're going to encourage them to read. And in the future, so much of our reading is now done online.
Mm-hmm.
So we're helping build that skill. And so many children are assessed on that first day of kindergarten. So many children are assessed using technology. So then the question is, are they being assessed
they
on
ready?
What they know?
Right.
Or are they being assessed on whether or not they can use technology?
Right,
and
that's such a great point.
We're covering all of those bases.
And you are breaking up in a huge way and innovating an early process that for too long has tracked kids
yes.
into the wrong groups. Even we think tracking's gone, but it's not, because if you're in a kindergarten, the teachers are going to go, I can't have them there. And I've told this story before, I've written about this, that I started out in a school in Allendale, New Jersey, with three of my friends who quickly went into different classes all the time, and I never figured out until later when they got to high school and they were put in vocational programs, that they were tracked with reading and math starting early on.
Right. Yeah.
Right? And this wasn't like a homogeneous community. This was just like, oh, you can't read as well, you can't do math as well, and somehow we were all split, and that's like the dirty little secret out there. Yeah. That people don't realize. So I think your program goes a long way to equalizing.
I had a phenomenal experience last week. This is a school-based experience, but I had a phenomenal experience. We visited two Head Start classrooms in Hillsborough County, Florida. Hillsborough County is the eighth largest school district in the country. They serve 220,000 children.
Wow.
They have 90-some Head Start classrooms, and we support in those classrooms, again, at 15 minutes a day. We walked through, and I'm going to shout out to them because they were amazing elementary schools, Potter Elementary and Dover Elementary in Hillsborough County. We went through those schools. Potter Elementary is deep inner city. You can see a lot of poverty around it, and it's this oasis in the middle of poverty, where these children were absolutely phenomenal, 3- and 4-year-olds, listening to their level of conversation and how and watching them write and watching them write letters and watching them, we saw some kindergartners who were writing sentences, and you know they are really breaking through the barriers of poverty, supporting children in such a phenomenal way, and we hope that we're a piece of that.
That's
that Waterford's
great.
A piece of that. In Dover, this is a migrant school in the middle of strawberry fields. So when you're out eating strawberries that are coming from Florida, this is the area they're coming from, and they are absolutely delicious, but you know, it's happening because of these families. And here I am in this, you know, what could be considered one of the poorest areas in the entire country, migrant children who are coming and going, and here is this little boy at 4 years old who says they were doing a phonemic awareness lesson where they were talking about rat and how many sounds were in the word rat and how could they change the word rat to cat, and the children were engaged and exciting and you know, understanding it completely. And then this one little boy raises his hand and he says, teacher, if you change the R to a T and the T to a P, you'd have tap. That is advanced phonemic awareness knowledge. And he wasn't asked to do it. It wasn't part of the lesson.
He was
able to do it.
Yes.
And those are the kinds of things that we teach.
Yes.
So even
it's
though if the teacher's not teaching at that moment,
right.
You know, he's seen that and it's giving them confidence and the ability to engage.
You know, you raise a great issue that we many of us know but we don't articulate enough, which is that just helping learn your language, the sounds of our language, preparation for reading. It also builds that curiosity.
It
builds that confidence that translates later on. It's just astounding, Anne. Well, thank you, Anne Brown, for joining me, Waterford Research Institute. Keep doing the great work and innovating.
You too. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining me for this edition of Reality Check, which has been brought to you live from ASU JSV 2019. I'm Jeannie Allen. Please subscribe if you haven't already wherever you get your podcasts. And tune in next week for another exciting edition of Reality Check.